Well, before we get to the tech stuff, I have a PSA to make.
Lay it on me.
And it's for any of you out there that are thinking about or have recently just shaved all your hair off in light of the quarantine. Remember to put sunscreen on your dome.
Because
I forgot, and you know, I've been taking Watson on walks, and my scalp was promptly burnt. That's why if you're looking at the stream, it's like my head looks kind of like really white at the very top. It's just sunscreen. It's just sunscreen because I burnt my head. And so yes, PSA out there, use sunscreen, please, because it's not fun.
My God. Well, thoughts and prayers.
Thank you. I need it. It is. I wish I had a thermometer in my office. So since I closed the door, my watch says it is now 86 degrees. So.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Obviously the watch is.
Wait, your watch?
Yeah. I'm just like pretending that it's getting hotter outside too. But yeah, it's 86. I'm not used to this. You know, this will be my first summer in Santa Rosa. I hear that it gets up to 100 degrees here.
Yeah. It's a dry heat. You know, they say that it's a dry heat, but it really is where you are, especially because you're kind of on the western part of Santa Rosa. Central, western, pretty much anywhere, though, you get the sea breeze that comes in the afternoon where it'll just be sunny, sunny, sunny all day, about 3, 3.30, 4 o'clock, just fog. Just fog just comes out of nowhere. It drops to, like, it feels like it's 50. Everything's damp for a couple hours, and then it just, and it's breezy and cold, and it feels like you're in the northwest. Like, it feels like you're in Seattle or something, just for a couple hours. And then everything goes back to blazing hot the next day. It's really, really bizarre. It's kind of like clockwork. Something about where it is. That was my experience, at least.
Well, I'll just dig a hole in the ground with Watson and just live in there for a little bit during the days. Nice and cool, you know?
There you go.
Take like a little tunnel underground or something, live under there. But yeah, it's interesting. I'm watching my like MacBook Pro is crazy hot. The fans are just spinning. I guess all of the problems, the first world problems you have when you have an aluminum computer with barely any fans in it. Basically an aluminum enclosure, right?
Yeah, and the whole thing's a heatsink. That's okay, though. Next year you can get an ARM MacBook and you won't have any heat problems, so it'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, did you see the refreshes that just came out? 13, I guess, more specifically?
Yeah, I was actually confused because I saw the news and then I went to check it and I was like, is this the new one? Did they change it? I mean, I get they updated the keyboard. Great, like we were expecting that, but not a lot else really changed. I thought it was middling, you know, not really disappointing. Obviously, it needed an update and needed a refresh. That's great, but like using previous gen processors and, you know, everyone wanted 14 inches, you know, maybe smaller bezels and bigger screen and stuff. But I listen, it's still a good upgrade. I still think the MacBook Air at this point is probably a better for most people. And if you want to get a pro, you might as well just go full on the 16-inch. You know, I don't know if someone asked me, like, I don't know if I'd recommend it necessarily.
I'm not upgrading. I have a 15-inch, and I would have considered upgrading to a 16-inch, but I don't think the keyboard would be nice, but I don't type on mine all that much. I have this nice little MX Keys, the new Logitech keyboard that I like quite a bit, actually.
Nice.
So that sort of, you know, kills that. And I have plenty of horsepower in it. So there's not like I need to. It would purely be for, I guess, reasons that aren't enough for me to open my wallet that much. So I will just see. I really would like to use this laptop till it dies. I've never really done that before with a Mac. And I just sort of want to ride out as many of these sort of incremental changes that I don't really care about as long as I can.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, the Mac you have now is pretty powerful. I mean, it should last you a while.
Yeah, I have if anyone is not aware, I have the 6-core version of the MacBook Pro, the 15-inch. So it's plenty for making web apps. It's just overkill for making web apps, certainly. But yeah, I'm hoping that's going to last a long time.
Wait, so what about your 8-core PC? Are you doing any dev on that? And we talked about it last week briefly.
Yes, I had been, but I my streak was broken, so I had to go away for a week, and so I just brought my laptop.
Okay.
Yeah, so when I came back, I just started using it again. But yeah, I still have the PC, and I still like to use it. It works fine. Windows has been fine. I just haven't switched over to it. I guess with Laravel specifically, there's Laravel Valet, which I've been using, which I really like, and I think there is a Linux version but it's not like an official version of it. And I read that there's some, so with Valet, you can do Valet share and it'll automatically spin up like an Ngrok port for you. And it does some stuff to make all the Laravel stuff work, which is actually really convenient, especially for testing on like my iPhone or my iPad or whatever. And I guess you have to do some extra work to make that work in Linux. And that literally has been enough of a straw to me not just to not do it, which is dumb, you know, because it probably wouldn't take that long.
You're so spoiled by how easy everything is in Laravel. You're like, oh, I have to run a couple of bash commands. Forget it.
Yeah, I mean, also, I haven't really been writing that much code, which we can talk about too, I guess. That's sort of a, not really like an official role change, but more of like an operating duties sort of change with Sidedoor. So I've actually been working most of the day for my iPad recently, which has been awesome.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah.
To be able to actually get work done on an iPad.
Yeah, yeah. So most of my day, I guess more what I've been doing, what I had been doing, I guess, you know, was writing all of the code and sort of doing the business planning and road mapping. But now that we have Jaggy and we have Charmaine as well, now that she works on the Sidedoor side of things, now that we have that going, or we have, you know, now that we have two people in the mix, it's basically like freed me up to really focus on all the other things that weren't just writing the, like building the platform. So by all the other things, I mean assisting the sales team, the marketing team, working on one of the big hoops we have to jump through is working with manufacturers and vendors. And manufacturers and vendors in this particular industry, do like none of them have their e-commerce data in order. So if you needed to, if they wanted to use your platform and you needed data from them, and if you went to them and say, all right, here's an Excel template, you know, can you get someone in your company to sort of give me an export that matches this template? 90% chance it's not going to happen. They don't have it. They don't have a person that knows how to do it. They just can't do it. So a large part of my job now has been, how do we fix that problem? How do we help them fix that problem? So I've gone from like spending all of my time writing code and thinking about like the technical aspects of the platform to sort of delegating that and switching over to some more of the business processes, the organization of those things, the documentation of those things, and solving more non-platform specific issues.
That's pretty cool. And you've been talking about transitioning to this role for a while. It's been sort of a gradual thing up to this point. I mean, I know you've kind of always had this responsibility on top of, you know, the actual getting, you know, putting your head down and writing code. You've kind of also had this responsibility of the documentation and the kind of interfacing between the requirements and what people want and what you can actually design. And now that you, you know, like I said, you're freed up for that, it gives you a lot more bandwidth to sort of do that at a higher capacity and higher quality, which I think is probably really important at this stage, you know, especially if you have two really, really competent developers who are just blazing ahead. Like, there's no way you're like at where you are now, like there's no way you could keep up, or even, you know, you couldn't be another third of that team, right? Like I feel like, you know, because obviously it's new tech stack and stuff. Not trying to put down your abilities or anything. I'm just saying you'd just be trying to play keep up the whole time, right? And you're much better,
100%
suited for this role.
And that's what I was feeling actually a lot. So I was sort of not disenfranchised. I don't know of another word to use there, but I just felt like I didn't know where I fit anymore in that scheme of things, because I felt like jumping in and writing code there, I felt like I was actually just getting in the way. And I would take longer to do something and you know, pull someone else's thought away from doing what they're doing. And honestly, all this other stuff too is just being neglected. So it's funny how it happens. But anyway, so like, yeah, I called up Greg and I was like, hey, Greg, here's what I'm thinking. So I basically, what I did was like, all right, I need to talk to someone that's been there that has more experience here than me. So I was like, Greg, bat signal. and he jumped on the phone with me and he was like, what's up? And I was like, all right, well, this is how I'm feeling. This is what I'm struggling with. And he was like, oh, it just sounds like you're just missing someone for this specific role, which is basically like a technical product manager or like head of product or whatever. And he was able to put a term to it. And so then I looked that up and I was like, oh yeah, this is exactly what I wish we had. And so then, you know, I talked with Lindsay and I was like, I think this is what I need to do right now and let them focus on the other stuff. And she says, that makes sense.
Because Lindsay never says no.
Well, Very rarely, but she it made a lot of sense to her because I told her, like, this is where I feel like we're lacking, and she kind of had felt the same thing too. So that was then I was like, I guess I'm doing this now, and she's like, sounds good, and that was it. You know, that was the end of the discussion. And so then I called up Chad and I was like, hey, what do you need from me? And he was like, oh man, let me get you a list, you know. So that feeling that I had like correctly identified something that we were missing. So that sort of that hole that was there in the organization. And once I was able to feel, I guess really all I wanted to feel like I was doing something meaningful. That's all I wanted to feel like. I was just doing something meaningful for the business. And now that I feel like I am, I've been sleeping better. I've been more productive. I've had like more clarity and thought in what I'm doing and working on. And I think a lot of that has to do with just, you know, the things running in the background of your mind, like, oh, well, there's A, B, and C that needs to be done on the sales and marketing website. They need this thing done, but that actually feels like it's pulling me away from my real role, in a sense, even though that, like, that stuff almost is equally as important. And so sort of distancing myself or like moving into a different role, now I feel free. I don't feel as conflicted when I'm doing these other tasks that still need to be done.
It's really interesting how just giving the role, giving yourself a title or giving the role a name, how much that kind of crystallizes it and it just kind of fits right into that slot that was kind of open before. I mean, it's the same thing with development. I mean, when you come up with a name for a concept or even just a variable or a function or a class or just a higher level concept, like, oh, really, what's the common features between these things? I don't mean features in the programming sense. I mean features in like how do these things fit together? And we do that all day, every day. We make those decisions as developers, trying to name things and do good decoupled, object oriented, reusable design. And I guess it's the same in the real world too. It's just applying those same principles. And again, once you just kind of put that little name to it, suddenly it's like, oh, this is a thing. It's the thing that exists now. I mean, maybe it didn't before.
Like, once you can identify the problem, that's how you can then go about solving it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's what I've been doing. A lot of writing, a lot of sort of going through. And up until this point, again, it's been sort of a weird transition, like side door starting as being like a feature in Design Collective to being its own entity, basically. And so I started taking more stock of our Notion or our documentation and looking at stuff. And I was like, oh, well, we need one main page where our business statement in value props are. Like, we need one spot where like our problem and solution sort of statements are, like a list of what our target audience, the problems they have and how we solve them specifically. Right. Because I wanted to go back to the website and start actually adding content to it. And then I was like, well, wait, what content do I add? So I sort of went back to the start of like, oh, well, if I don't know what content to add, then where's the content? Oh, well, there's no content. Okay, well, I have to write it, you know? So that's what I've been doing, you know, just actually have just been standing on my deck. I tweeted out a picture earlier this week and wanted to know if it made people nervous because I had a board that I propped my laptop on a third story balcony. So it turns out that the balcony railing is perfect standing height. So I can stand there and I can just write on the third floor and I get a nice breeze to keep myself cool. But that's what I've been doing this week, is just standing and writing basically the whole week.
That's terrifying. Get a couple of clamps or something.
It's fine. I'll sort it out. I mean, if it falls, I just get it at a 16, right? I'll just use like Apple Care or whatever. Like, I don't know what happened to it, I swear.
There's an earthquake.
Yeah. But yeah, on top of that, like doing a lot of research too. You know, trying to wade through the BS of like, here's how you make a landing page. The three, you know what I mean? There's so many courses and articles out there that are, I don't know, just not really substantive. They're sort of derivative copies. So I've been trying to find like, where are all these people copying from, basically? And I remember that Paul shared it's like a guidebook kind of a while back. I'll put a link to the show notes. But this guy named Julian has this company that sort of does this as a consulting firm for startups. And so he wrote sort of a guide on how growth marketing and landing pages and stuff. So I've just been going through that. And he started the content phase. I was like, all right, I guess I need to start the content phase, and just sort of been going along, you know, following the guidebook down each step and sort of just trying to implement the steps as I can, the best of my ability, I suppose, which I'm learning. It's not great, but I'm making an effort at it.
Really, it sounds like what it comes down to is communication, right? Like you're spending your day communicating with people, whether that's in writing or in meetings or in documentation, right? Like you're kind of this hub and all the other people in the organization are kind of the spokes and you're kind of like Bob in Office Space. I'm a people person. Take the requirements from the engineers, or no, take the requirements from the customers, bring them to the engineers. You're basically Bob, except less layoffable.
Part of this is actually like getting on calls with the sales, like with Chad or sales guy, and sort of listening along and answering more technical questions, or fielding the more technical questions that come in, or, you know, writing help docs. I started up a help doc site for us, and so we can start linking to that, so our staff can link to if there are more technical questions about how something works or why something works a certain way. You know, I try to write it down in the doc and then we could link into it later. So it saves time for the sales staff, but also it saves errors that can happen and miscommunications, I think, too. Like if a salesperson doesn't technically know how something works, or like why we're specifically not doing a feature, that can come up in conversation. And it's easier if you have a technical, like if you have a document that sort of codifies it as a source of truth to, you riff off of that, not sort of ad hoc, like, oh yeah, we're solving problems. We can do that. We can do that too. And then like down the road, I find out, wait, I've never heard of that feature that we're now supposedly promising people. So I'm basically trying to think of all the problems or things that have gone wrong with MVPs and clients I've had in the past and just solve them ahead of time or help us steer away from those things ahead of time. And, that leads me into like a question I had for you actually. So a lot of, you know, obviously, like I said, I'm doing a lot of writing and thinking and brainstorming and like trying to outline features and outline what we're not doing, you know, problems that the designer might have that we don't want to solve or that we don't think fits in the scope of what we're building. And that's been a real challenge there. And I was going to ask, like, cause RHR has been around for a while. And I was going to ask if you had any sort of like process or criteria or characteristics that you might use for saying no to something versus saying yes to something, or even knowing when an idea comes along, that's probably pretty important. And you should, you know, pivot a little bit to target that.
I will say, start off by saying the system we have probably would not recommend. This is what we've done out of necessity. It's not great. It doesn't lead to the best results. But here's how things go down, right? We're three people. four people, really, now. And there's really only two technical people on the team, right? Me and Lee. And we spend a lot of time brainstorming ideas. Big picture stuff, really, really fine, detailed stuff. And, of course, it's my job to be the nitpicky, think about all the edge cases. What about this? What about that? How does this behave? I've been living in OmniGraphful this past week. I've drawn so many state diagrams for so many different things, not only for RHR, but even for like client work now too. I just, anyway, getting on a tangent.
Yeah.
Here's what we do. We don't say no to things in general. There's very rarely a time where I'm like, that's a bad idea. Forget it. Right, like, what we'll do is we'll get the idea down, put it into a GitHub issue or whatever issue tracking system of the week that we're using, and then we'll just let it sit, just let it marinate, right? And so that way the idea's there. In fact, this has happened the other day. We had it wasn't really even a big feature request, just like, hey, we need this one little config feature flag here. And I'm like, that rings a bell. Go, GitHub issues. Oh, November 2018. It's already in there. We just never got around to it. Everything old is new again. So what we do is we'll get everything down on paper and then deal with fires as they come along and deal with big picture stuff. But when it comes time to, there comes a time when you need to decide what to do about all that crap. There's this big backlog or whatever word you want to use for it of issues. And we're going to do it probably this week or next week. Spring cleaning. We're going to go through all the issues. We're going to prioritize. We're going to be like, oh, we actually by implementing these other features, we actually knocked a bunch of these off the list without even realizing it. Go through and delete, clean, and that, looking at that past collection of all those issues, really kind of crystallizes, whether you realize it or not, what's important to us, what we prioritize without even thinking about it, because you start to draw patterns like, oh, these four or five things are really this big thing over here, or this one or two things indicate a bigger problem that we need to solve, and we need to focus on it. And then it comes down to prioritizing and finding time, right? But that's kind of how we do it. It's just kind of iterative cycle. It's very informal. Obviously, we don't have any kind of formal review times. It's just when we have time and when it feels right, we got to go through and do that stuff. So everything gets into the system, and then it's just a matter of pulling it back out of it in a way that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense.
Again, not terribly effective. Problems with the system are obviously it's hard to see at any given point kind of where you are, how much progress you've made, what you're actually working on, and what's important right now. You know, doing things moment to moment is important when you're kind of in this growing phase, but once you're sort of well established and have things figured out, it becomes a lot harder actually to figure out what to work on next because there's so many things and you already have this established thing that works, so it's not always even clear what to work on. And so that's kind of, I think, the phase we're at now where it's really, we have lots of cool ideas. The stack works. Don't want to like touch it and break it and do too many crazy things at this point. Obviously, we want to keep moving forward and do all those cool little things. But at the same time, like, I guess it's just deciding what's important to us and the customers and the business as a whole. And that's going to honestly change from month to month or day to day even. But that's kind of where we're at.
Do you have any customers that... It's not one to one. It's different. It's sort of different. I guess like one of the tough things with e-commerce is that you'll always have a certain class of customer that wants to make a pile of money without doing anything. So RHR doesn't necessarily make your users money. And with e-commerce, I've noticed it with DK. I'm noticing it already with people that are like reaching in or like, you know, reaching out to us to get more information about Sidedoor, learn what it is and everything. And there's just a certain class of people that are just like, well, can I just put all of your products on my one site and then just have people click through and then me get paid for it? And I'm like, what you're describing is an affiliate system. And no, that's not what we're building. But it's like a constant class or type of customer that's not what we're building. That's something we want. But anytime you talk about any sort of listing products anywhere, you'll start to get all these affiliate and I don't know. It's not what we're building. Our goal is to make our customers money, but it's not an affiliate system and it's not like a embed thousands of products on a website. What's then there's just really no benefit to that because people are just going to go to Wayfair House and Amazon. Shipping is always going to be cheaper, you know? So that's one thing I'm dealing with a little bit is like trying to weed out like what's actually a good idea and what actually is an idea stemming from, I don't really want to do anything. I just want to make a bunch of money and I want you to put a crap ton of data on a page for me.
I would say our analog to that is the power user. Okay. They use the system a lot and we kind of want to prioritize them because they're good customers, right? They use the system quite a lot and they know every feature in and out. They want all the latest features. They want to use the newest thing as soon as possible. And those kind of people are great to have around. There's also a very small number of them compared to everyone else. And you still have to design a product that you know, you still have to make advances that benefit everyone. You can't just cater to the one or two power users all the time, right? And they're also, not only are they power users in the sense that they're on there a lot, but they're demanding. You know, there's lots of features that they want because they run into some limitation. Or they use it so often they find weird bugs or edge cases that we hadn't considered. You know, they're really, really high maintenance too. You know, it kind of comes along with it. And so that is, you know, you still want a relationship with them. This is a small community. Everyone has their call sign attached to their name. So it's like, that's your identity. Like your call sign is who you are. And you really don't want to tarnish that in any way, shape, or form because that's... That's who you are. That's how people know you. You know what I mean? And the community's small, word spreads fast, everything's word of mouth. So you really don't want to burn any bridges there if you can help it.
Yeah.
Unless unless it's really, really egregious. But that aside, that's hard because all the stuff that we're power users too. Obviously, we built this for ourselves to be this cool system, and we want, you know, like I said before, we have all these cool features that we can't even, we don't even want to tell people what's in the pipeline because they're just going to demand it. When is this coming out? When is this coming out? Can't do that. I can't fall into that trap. No way. We, you know, it's an easy mistake to make. Let something slip out, and then all they're doing is demanding it, wanting it. So it's challenging, you know. Trying to walk that balance and, you know, occasionally helping the high profile users out, but also finding time to work on the general improvements.
Yeah. And I think it's especially difficult for me right now too, because, you know, I've never really been a product manager before. And also on our, you know, our sales stuff, I'm still working on the materials. What we have right now is it was very like set up a site that has the basic gist of the process of getting into the beta. You know, so it's very much about here's like a very thin gist of what we're doing. If this sounds interesting, apply for access to a beta that's coming later. Yeah. And so I'm trying to take that and translate it to a, here's what this thing is. And part of that is, you know, part of the copy that I'm writing is trying to steer those people into seeing what we're trying to communicate the vision and articulate the vision correctly. And one thing I've been noticing actually is that a lot of the early copy mentions specific pieces of technology or specifically mentions like customer's website or the client's website specifically. And I started noticing that the people that started asking questions, like getting into the nitty-gritty details that maybe weren't exactly what we're building or sort of off in the weeds somewhere, they were all stemming from, oh, I saw this thing that was more specifically talking about my website or something more specific in the tech and not necessarily conceptual, if that makes sense. So if we're talking about like, if we're embedding stuff on your website and we mention embeds, there's going to be 100 questions to have about embeds specifically, right? So what I'm trying to do is sort of steer the conversation away from the tech specific or the solution specific things. Solution specific, maybe even the wrong way to say it. I'm basically trying to steer the conversation to a place where I want it to go and get them to see things the way I'm trying to see it or trying to communicate it to them. And one thing I did notice, like I said, was removing some of these tech-specific things sort of helps with that. It seems to pigeonhole the questions a little bit less, which was really interesting. So that was one thing I was doing, was I was sort of doing some exercises. Like I'd open a Notion doc, I would write a prompt and be like, all right, everybody, you know, what are some problems and solutions? Let's go. And then everyone sort of like starts writing it. And then immediately I started noticing like, oh, it's just like all these really specific things are starting to mix in here, which are going to lead to more questions. So I started pulling those out. Like, all right, well, let's move this down farther down on the page. Maybe that should be on a feature page. Maybe that should be like somewhere else, you know? And I noticed that when we started changing some of the materials, we started getting a lot less of those very specific pigeonhole questions, which was nice. But yeah, really, I guess it's just been a huge learning experience for me because I've never done this before. All I can do is read, you know? So my whole career, it's been me figuring out tech things. Like, I've never built this feature before. How do I figure it out? Well, you just go and read docs and take notes. Well, now I'm like navigating through like marketing guru websites and, you know, books and articles and stuff and figuring that out, which feels very much the same but very different at the same time.
The podcast audience couldn't see it, but he was using air quotes around guru.
Oh, guru, yes. Sorry, I was using, yeah. Basically, I just need to have like a snake oil detector next to me at all times.
You got to work on your SEO, man.
Oh, man, yeah.
No, it's funny because what you're describing, it brought back this weird memory. You know what it reminds me of is when I was training for my private pilot's license, the last step of the license is a, they call it a check ride. And it's in two parts. You, an examiner who's licensed by the FCC, or excuse me, the FAA, an examiner comes down, you spend a couple hours doing sort of an oral examination. You can plan a imaginary flight. You have to explain all the different things. They can ask you questions. Are you legal to fly? What's the airspace like? So on and so forth. What things do you consider in this flight? Runways? Can you calculate this? Calculate that? Whatever. And then there's the practical portion of the flying, obviously, as well. One of the things they tell you over and over again, this was just not only from my instructor, but I'd heard this over and over, was when the examiner asks you a question, don't offer any additional information. If they ask you a question, you answer that question exactly. And you don't don't not only just not hedging your bets, but like don't give too much. And you basically don't want to open any doors that they can kind of poke their head in and ask you additional questions, because then you're just going to dig yourself a metaphorical hole. Ideally, you're going to be able to answer any questions they have, but you don't want to be put yourself into that situation. It sounds like that's what you're doing by writing sort of technical documentation or solutions to things where suddenly you use certain words and phrases and, oh, people have questions, or they might have negative connotations. Oh, embeds don't work for us. We've tried that. Or my web designer says we can't do embeds, or they're bad, or whatever, right?
Yeah, it goes all the way from, I want to be able to embed everything that I have access to in my Sidedoor account onto my website. So basically, I want your website to be on my website now, which that's a custom domain. That's different. That's no longer an embed. And although it goes from that all the way to, I don't even have a website. So how do I use your stuff then? You know, which we obviously have a solution for, but it's like, if we would have said embed in the first place, neither of those questions would have come up, and they would have started asking more questions about the business and less about the, and that's what I meant, like, by removing the tech stuff. Yeah. Like not even giving them an angle to sort of wiggle in there, because when the time is right, you know, I'll write that documentation, hopefully to be clear, we'll have videos and screenshots of stuff, but we don't have that now. So a lot of it's like controlling the narrative, I guess.
Yeah. Every customer is coming into it with their own. They have a preconceived notion of what their problems are and how you're going to solve them. And if you start, you know, so if you start at the high level, then they can kind of narrow down their focus and understand how their needs fit into the system that you're offering, as opposed to coming at the other direction where you're like, we have all these solutions. And they're like,
yeah, trying to find the sweet spot on that. But, yeah, anyway, you did mention something earlier that I want to talk about that's more tech-specific. And you were mentioning something about OpenAPI and Swagger. And you've been chatting about it a little bit in Discord, and this is something that's really interesting to me. So, you know, I went through that code test with this. I don't think I've sent the company's name, so I'll just leave it. And so I was making an API. And so when I had to make the API, I was like, okay, well, do I do GraphQL? Or do I go a RESTful route? Like, this isn't a huge API, so maybe I don't need GraphQL. And then I started looking at the different ways to sort of document that or design that. And I was like, well, okay, there's JSON API, there's REST, there's Swagger, there's OpenAPI, there's any number of specs you can follow for building an API. And so then I was like, screw it, I'm just doing GraphQL because it is what it is, and it's self-documenting, right? And I've never really, in so far in my career, I've never really dug into any of the other sort of REST API, I guess you'd call them specifications, or any of the tooling that sort of auto-generates documentation and things for you. So I'm actually really interested to hear what you're doing over there and what your experience has been.
Yeah, so full disclaimer, neither have I until yesterday. Every API I've ever written has basically been for my own consumption. So that didn't really necessitate a need for, that's not true. Of course, like, you should document it, but I never bothered to document it, except for in case for GraphQL, like you said, where it is sort of self-documenting. Yeah, I was in this position. I'm working on this stuff for Glance, and we've literally had this idea for this project for, let's see, I found a Google Doc from November 2018, so 2.5 years. We've been trying to get this project off the ground, and granted, this is not, it's not a hard project from my perspective. It's an API with 5 endpoints, 5 queries, okay?
Ooh.
With an existing database. Anyway, I've been doing this work for Glance, and we need an API access into some of their existing systems so that we can build this other system that is leveraged off it. Pretty straightforward stuff. We know they have a web app. We know there's a web page. You can go to it and see a table of data. And we basically, and you can do some operations, enable, disable, add, remove, right? That's it. Enable, disable, add, remove, list. 5 operations. And you can do it with this little ASP.NET web page. You go into the thing, you can check things, enable, disable, add, remove. There's a form with 2 fields on it. Great. We needed programmatic access to be able to replicate what that form does, because we need it for some of the auto-scaling stuff that we're building. And so we finally have someone, manpower, in the company to work on it. Great. The guy we're working with, he's self-proclaimed newbie. He's been at the company less than a year, and it's not really a web app developer per se. You know, I asked him, I kind of gauged interest. He's like, you know, I've read about it, but I had never really done it before. Fine. Perfect. So they've got a ticket, and I'm like, okay, I know, I have this in my head. I know exactly what the API should look like. And of course, we should back up because, like, what does the API look like, right? We're integrating with this existing system that other developers are going to use. This is not my product. This is something that I need so I can write my thing. They need to be able to maintain this. I'm not going to go with GraphQL. They don't have anything that's GraphQL. They do have some web services. They do have some documentation about how their web services should be laid out, what the error codes and stuff should look like. I didn't even know this, but apparently it exists. I learned today. Great. So we're going to write a traditional RESTful web API with JSON payloads. Great. Okay. I feel like that's the most sort of universal thing that will be understood by current and future people for this product, because this is like got to be a very small, stable, well-defined application.
Right.
Time comes to write the API spec. Open up VS Code. Start. Put it in Markdown mode. Start typing. Start a code block. Deep sigh. This is the wrong way to do this.
Oh no.
Yeah. Go over to Discord. Hey guys. I heard Swagger's cool. Is it cool? Is there anything cool or newer? Crickets. 5 minutes go by. I go to the Swagger webpage. I sign up for Swagger Hub. You get an integrated side-by-side left side. Here's the Swagger API spec with a demo thing about a pet store. Like something about pets. I don't know. The right side, generated documentation. I go through. It's a big YAML file. I copy and paste and define my own spec there. There's beautiful documentation. Still no reply in Discord. An hour later, I have the API spec done, documented, fully specified. Error codes, success codes, schemas, all my five things are there, and I'm done. Like, oh, this is great. And then there's a little tool you can go and like generate native client APIs. There wasn't one for Ruby, weirdly, but for lots of different languages, you just go and download generated code. You talk about CodeGen with Go. Like, Go is definitely on there. Like, you can just generate a client that conforms this API, throw it in your app, and away you go. You can even generate, they'll even generate and host mock servers for you. Like, you just click a button and they spin up a mock server that conforms to the API, so you have something to test against right away.
That's pretty cool.
That's cool. And it's like, oh, these are problems that web developers have had for years, and all this stuff's been going on, and just because we never really cared to, like, it's all magical that it's at this point. Obviously, I'm sure it took years. They're on Swagger version 3 now, I guess. It's called Open the API Spec. I don't actually even know what the right term is. The point is, these tools seem to be very mature. They did exactly what I wanted. They solved the exact problem. I feel like it's really easy. Like, as we had some meetings today, I was like, oh, this doesn't really work the way I wanted. Went in, changed the YAML file. Boom. Like, it's done. And what I did was, this is really cool. This is an extra bonus. I didn't even realize this. We're using GitLab for version control for this project. So I was like, okay, let me put the spec into Git. Put it up to a GitLab thing. It's just a YAML file. I go over to the GitLab web interface, click on that YAML file, and I don't see a YAML file. I don't see raw source code. I see beautiful generated documentation in GitLab.
Mm.
Like, it knows what a Swagger API spec looks like, and it just shows you documentation. That was awesome.
Like, right.
It's just so perfect. And I was like, oh, all this tooling was really, really worth it. And to be able to have a clear line of communication with a sort of green web app developer, and he can kind of look at it and know exactly what I'm thinking and what needs to happen. Or just, I mean, it's really true of any developer, but especially when you really maybe don't know what's going on. Man, I that was just a really nice experience. Maybe this is old hat to some people. I was just very pleased by it fitting the application perfectly.
Yeah, well, I came across a tweet earlier today. Again, as with everything, sort of the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, but the gist of the tweet was, you should not be reinventing any wheels unless you're doing it in the purpose of learning. Especially in the context of web applications or SaaS applications, majority of problems have been solved. And so there's no real reason for you to reinvent the wheel unless it's for the purpose of learning why the wheel or how the wheel was invented in the first place. And I've just been thinking about that a little bit today. Again, truth is in the middle. Like, it's hard to state a fact like that as being completely truthful, but that sort of makes me think about that. Like, yeah, you could have gone in and sort of, and you have the experience to go in certainly and develop the, or design the API, make sure all the edges are covered, you know, error codes, error shapes, statuses, stuff like that. But Swagger exists. And if it fits the solution, fine. And you're willing to concede with whatever quirks it might have. Again, I don't know. I've never used it, so I don't know if it has any. But if you're willing to you know, concede to those, you just inherit from the ecosystem. And people have been working on it for a long time. So like you said, suddenly you go to GitLab and you have live documentation. And you're like, this is awesome, you know? And even more importantly, you know, you're sort of on the outside looking in of the Glance team. And so you're able to say, here's a very well-established thing with tons of resources. So now if this person needs help figuring this out, they don't have to go, they don't have to only go to you for help. They can go to the greater community at large. And chances are someone else at Glance has experience with it, you know, they can help out. So that's, I don't know, that's great to hear. That's kind of how I feel with the current situation with Sidedoor and the tech choices there. It feels very, very similar. I mean, granted, you can build things with Phoenix really quickly, but I've had to build many, many less things by using a more established ecosystem. But and I guess another thing I was going to mention too was Insomnia actually just launched a companion app to, I guess, Insomnia. So Insomnia being the REST client that you can use to sort of debug APIs and GraphQL APIs, they released Designer, which sounds a lot like Swagger Hub. So it sounds like Swagger Hub, you sort of can, you build up your API Designer schema and it sort of generates the docs for you on the side, or generate, like you can use it to generate code and stuff.
Yeah, it does a bunch of stuff in addition, all surrounding the concept of the API specs as like a project, as like a, as a atomic unit of work. Yeah.
Right. So it looks like Designer, that's kind of what that does too. And it has Swagger or OpenAPI built in as well. And it mentions it being collaborative too, which is interesting. I know they have like syncing. I don't know if it's real time, but I know from talking to some people there that it seems like they're going to build some really interesting stuff into it as well. So, you know, obviously the code gen side of things exists in it as well. But I think they're talking about even like being able to run tests. So you can sort of run like outside in style or integration style tests against your API to make sure it actually does conform. So make sure implementation conforms to what the specification designed was. I don't know exactly how that works, but that sounds like an interesting tool that could be useful.
Yeah, it sounds really, really powerful. And like you said, I'm also not really able to fully grok it, I think, because I'm not in that headspace all the time about API design everything. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if you do a lot of different designs or have done this for a long time, everything there makes a lot of sense. But I'm not fully able to grasp really. I'm sure it's awesome. I just yeah. I don't know enough to say much about it beyond that.
We haven't really had the use case either, and neither have I. So, but yeah, that's really cool. I again, like thinking about that tweet, you shouldn't be reinventing the wheel unless you're doing it for purposes of learning. That would just been, I'll probably keep thinking about that this week and try to find out where the truth is there for me. Obviously there's a lot of stuff I want to learn. And like I was saying, the Go sort of the Go test that I had forced me to learn a lot about things I have sort of just taken for granted, you know? So like I was talking about taking for granted in with the Phoenix system, how you just get like a logger and you get a REPL and you get database migrations and you get all this stuff sort of for free. And then I jump into Go and I was like, oh, I have to choose all of this or make it. And if I choose incorrectly, then they aren't play together. So then I have to make it anyway, you know? And so that, I think that's why maybe that was more timely for me, because I had just experienced that sort of reinventing the wheel myself, and it was for learning. And it felt good. And then, you know, jumping into PHP land and all that. It's been a strange few weeks for me, honestly. It just feels like nothing is what it once was. A lot of changes happening really quickly.
So another funny anecdote or development in the whole Glance project. Our big goal here at this project is to enable them to auto scale servers up and down. Sounds simple, but when you have a bunch of existing infrastructure and things that have to work a certain way, there's a lot of coordination that has to happen before servers can be created and be destroyed. The first iteration of this project was a Phoenix application. You host on a little server, the server's phone home, the thing coordinates, hey, you get this IP address, hey, you can get disabled, you get enabled, you can have logic for scaling, great. Then we sat down, we're like, oh, Like, no one else is going to be able to maintain this. No one can do bug fixes on it if I'm gone, not working on it. No one knows Phoenix and Elixir. This is a bad solution. Let's write it in Rails. Everyone knows Rails. I wrote a Rails application, does the same thing. It's great. Deployed Elastic Beanstalk, has a Postgres thing, set up some security groups. Great. You've got this little Rails application. It has a beautiful Tailwind interface, and but really most of the functionality is just in a couple of basically webhooks. Awesome. That was, I don't know, 6 months ago. It's been sitting there. They've been using it in dev and staging. We're working fine. Time comes now to pick this project up again. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, all right, we need to deploy this thing to production. Sigh. Deep sigh. the theme of the show. Deep sigh.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is a whole thing. It's just there's really, like, there's not a lot of things here that need to happen. There's like a little bit of coordination. You got to talk to AWS API. You got to talk to this new Glance API, which we're developing now, is actually being actively done and worked on. Great. But, like, there doesn't really need to be the central source of truth for doing this is AWS. Like, the AWS API has everything we need to know about the state of where things are in terms of scaling up and scaling down. You don't need a Postgres database that you have to sync up and keep track of and do backups and can maintain and update version. Oh, God, I'm like stressed out just talking about it. And then Lee was talking with one of the other developers on the team, and he relayed this to me. He's like, this guy said, he's like, oh, another tech stack. It's like they don't have any Rails stuff there. What? Why am I trying to introduce this totally foreign technology in this whole world of knowledge that needs to be absorbed into doing this fairly simple task? Obviously, we have bigger ideas for where we want it to go, but those are future problems. Like, these are not the problems we're trying to solve right now and immediately need. And the problems that were actually the future problems that we're thinking about, turns out if you think about them hard enough, it's actually like a completely separate concern. Like, we've got what we're doing here on the left side, and on the right side, that's like a Boolean, right? Boolean thing. And the overlap is actually very, very small. So once we came to that conclusion, we're like, all right, open up OmniGraffle, draw a state machine. That's like my first, this is like my meditation phase. Can I draw a state machine? Just start doing it. And turns out we can do everything we need just on the servers themselves. I mean, we're starting servers. They can run code. Like, you have servers there. Why not just put all this logic on the servers themselves, so when they come up, they can just configure themselves and do everything? And once we hit on that idea, we've thought about it for a while. And anyway, long story short, if we can take all this logic and put it on the servers that are managed themselves more or less with this one little API that we need, a couple of API calls, we don't need all this extra infrastructure. We don't need to deploy a Rails application to 7 different AWS regions and keep all the code up to date and manage the Postgres databases there. Oh, and by the way, they're staging in production and dev and QA. So that's 4 AWS accounts across a dozen different regions. God, what a nightmare to maintain and deploy that. No, thank you. We're just going to put burn this code into these little AWS instances, these images. So when the image comes up, everything will just magically work. And like, coming to that realization and kind of working around the technology, man, just stripping it down and simplifying the technology into that kind of solution, it's going to be a little bit more work, and maybe it won't be as robust as having this sort of single source of truth Rails application. But like, we can get around that. We can be smart about it and just take a couple of extra steps in the registration and deregistration process where you're sort of turning these servers on and off. Just be a little smart about it and think about it for like 5 minutes. It's totally fine. It's totally decentralized. It's going to be great. And like, there's all this kind of weight off your shoulder of having to maintain this a whole other stack. So I don't know. As I get older, I just seem to want to do that more and more.
Right. It's like the pragmatic solution.
Yeah. I don't want to be pragmatic to a fault, but I feel like it's the right thing for this.
I mean, it sounds right. Like, if the team's able to make it work without having to have to learn an additional stack, then I think that sounds like the right choice.
And the question comes, okay, what do you write these scripts in to do this stuff? Is it just shell scripts? God, I hope not. Is it JavaScript node stuff? Is it Python? I don't know. Still to be determined.
It's PHP scripts. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, whatever, I guess whatever they're most familiar with, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you're on the right path.
So that was just another funny development. Oh, another tech stack.
Yeah. I can only imagine, I suppose, like being informed, like, oh, you're receiving this thing. And then, because someone else is basically going to be in charge of maintaining it, right? So they're inheriting it. They're inheriting sort of the maintenance of it, the operate, like understanding how it works, right? Because someone has to know, like someone in-house has to know how it works in and out.
Yeah, that's true. I got to make a plan for kind of passing on that knowledge. I don't even know how that's going to work. I haven't gotten that far yet. Let's get it in production first, and then we can figure out who can babysit it.
Let's get some services depending on it first, and then you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
You can mind meld with them.
Man, what a week. What a week.
Yeah. The world's just nothing. It's just different. It just feels different, you know? Quarantine happening, PHP and me not writing code much at all. It just feels... Things are all like turning upside down, but that's all right.
Somehow I've been more stressed with work since quarantine. Like everyone's staying home, working from home and stuff. And we've always been working from home and like really nothing has changed, but it still feels different. I think one of the things that's contributing to that is the fact that sort of everybody's more connected and you're always available. I'm using air quotes. You're always available, right? Because, yeah. Oh, you're at home. You know, we can, and whether you're available for work or available for personal stuff, you're available because you're home. Now everyone else is home too. And so there's some extra boundaries that need to be drawn there. Otherwise, you're just going to be driven crazy.
Yeah. I've been more diligent about keeping these on Do Not Disturb and keeping the phone away from the bed and stuff like that. Just really have to. I've also stopped listening to like news podcasts, because that was usually how I started my morning, was like a quick catch up on the news and things like that. Stopped doing that. Started with just maybe some chill music or something while I'm making coffee and doing some stretching, which has helped a lot too. So yeah, I really think like it's not even necessarily all work and job related. It's more so sort of just extra stress from everything that's going on, and that easiest way for it to manifest is through feeling stressed about work, I think. Or maybe that's what I've been finding for myself anyway. But
tight shoulder muscles, that's how it manifests. I can feel it right now.
Tight shoulder muscles. Yeah.
Just a ball of knots over here.
Yeah. I got one of these like handheld massager things, and you can put like a point on it, and you can dig into any knot. You'll find any knot in your body, and it hurts, but it works really well.
Can I attach to Bucky and just have him crawl on me? He's 14 pounds. It could work, right?
I'll send Watson. He's 100 pounds or 90 pounds.
Jesus.
I'll send him over there.
Just put a couple of treats down, or put that Kong down. You can roll it on your back.
I'll just put peanut butter in the back of your head. That'll work. All right, well, I guess it's time to wind this thing down so I can turn my fan back on. It's hot in here.
I'll take some. Let's average out our temperatures. It'll be great.
Well, it's getting cooler outside. It's now 80 degrees, but, you know.
You get that fog soon.
Yeah, hopefully.
When I was at Agilent, they did this thing where what did they do? It was kind of to prevent fire risk and stuff, I think. What they did was at the end of the winter, at the end of the rainy season, when everything was still green, they hired a shepherd, and he just like lived on the property in a trailer somewhere, because they have like this huge piece of property on top of a hill, and I would say most of it is undeveloped, and there's like trails and stuff on the property. It's a couple obviously huge factory buildings, but then the rest of it is basically undeveloped. And so what he does is he's got two dogs and, I don't know, 40 or 50, are they goats or sheep? I don't remember. And he just pens off an area, and they will just eat everything from like 3 feet to the ground, completely stripped bare of anything green, trees, yeah, grass, anything. And then he just moves them around and herds them. And it's just fascinating to watch. And you're trying to do work, and all you hear is, meh. Just constantly. Man, that was cool. No, you know what it was? I think it was actually like basically mowing the lawn. That's what they were doing, and kind of environmentally friendly fertilizer, free fertilizer kind of way. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
That's a very Vermont sounding thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if anyone has any feedback or questions or comments about what we talked about today, and especially maybe, you know, any comments or thoughts on the idea that you shouldn't be reinventing wheels unless it's for learning, let us know. I'm really interested to hear what other people think about that. I just want to hear, I know what my thoughts on it are, but I want to hear what other people's thoughts are, because I'm sure someone has a thought that I haven't considered so far. So if you have any thoughts on that, let us know.
As always, you can reach us on Twitter, DNCcast. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I am Shrock Wallet.
And as always, the show notes will be available at dnc.show. So any of the stuff we talked about today, Glance, Swagger, Omni Grapple, Insomnia Designer, all the links are in the show notes. So head on over to dnc.show to get access to those.
And of course, join us live on twitch.tv/dnccast. Thursday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. It's our normal time. Check Twitter for changes. We're streaming live. It's cool. We're doing it live. Come say hi, ask questions, correct us on our mistakes. Look at Sean's beautiful, bald, sunburned head.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder how long it'll take my hair to grow back. I shaved it not that long ago. Well, I shaved it right before moving back to California, so I guess I'm sort of used to it by now, but it does still look a little weird when I see it. And as always, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out in the world and, you know, supporting us. So if you're interested in other design and development related podcasts, head on over to spec.fm and check them out.